Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program. Want to remind you, you can follow us on Twitter at What Matters NC. We have a good show for you planned today. We will be talking with Stephanie Keveny of the Pope Center for Higher Education and Joe Bastardi of WeatherBell.com. Going to get us up to date on all of the goings-on in the Gulf and on the East Coast and what kind of plans we might be able to make for the upcoming Labor Day weekend. Well, the top story of the day is the Supreme Court refused to grant a stay in North Carolina's voter ID law. In a 4-4 split decision, the court said it would not hear a challenge to a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that struck down parts of the law. We caught up with Francis DeLuca of the Civitas Institute, and he had this to say about the decision.
I'm disappointed, but not surprised by the Supreme Court decision. Probably the most disappointing thing is that Chief Justice John Roberts didn't exercise his authority to stay the Fourth Circuit decision like he did in 2014 to give the court time to review the entire case, not just reviewing the stay decision. By throwing it to the entire Supreme Court with the current makeup, the Chief Justice knew the outcome ahead of time. And that's what I'm most disappointed in. He had the authority. He's actually ruled in favor of many of the things in our law previously. So I don't think it was a real hard thing for him to have stayed it and, again, allowed the court next year to review all aspects of the law.
Well, Senator Phil Berger, who is the president pro tem of the North Carolina Senate and speaker of the North Carolina House, Tim Moore issued a joint statement saying, "We respect the court, but are disappointed North Carolina will not be among the more than 30 other states with common sense voter ID in place for the upcoming election." Governor Pat McCrory said that North Carolina has been denied basic voting rights already granted to more than 30 other states. And so the protection of the upcoming election from an integrity standpoint has now been cast aside. There will be no voter ID requirements, and who knows what the outcome of that will be. It would seem to make good sense that if you want to make sure that there is integrity in the election process, showing a simple ID, which is something that people do every day in every part of their lives, is not a big deal. Again, I've said many times that nobody's vote was going to be suppressed under any part of North Carolina's election reform law, and yet the Supreme Court now refusing to hear this case. And as Francis DeLuca said, they could have allowed the voter ID process to go on in this election and then reviewed the whole case next year. But Chief Justice John Roberts, surprisingly, candidly, did not do that. Well, as I said, we have a very big show for you today, and let's get right to it. Joining us now on What Matters in North Carolina is Stephanie Keveny. She is a policy associate with the John William Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. Stephanie, always a pleasure. Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, you've written an article that I found very intriguing a couple of days ago, and our listeners can find it at popecenter.org. It's entitled "The Freshman Experience: Social Justice Indoctrination and Academic Handholding." Now, before we get into the specifics, seems to me, and you can tell me if you agree or not, but this is something that's happening more and more across the country. Seemingly this year, it's really taken on kind of a life of its own.
Absolutely. I mean, we're 2 weeks into the new academic year, and we've already seen just a whole ton of stories coming out of national media about new courses and new diversity programs at universities, and it doesn't seem to have quelled the demand for safe spaces and trigger warnings and everything else that we've seen on college campuses the last few years.
Well, again, before we dive into your article, what do you think is driving this, Stephanie? Why all of a sudden is it so important, seemingly, that college students, especially freshmen, are suddenly coddled like children?
I think part of it is university administrators trying to avoid the things like the protests that we saw at the University of Missouri last year, where it really just shut down the entire campus. We have university administrators now trying to kind of appease the students who are demanding that they do more about gender equality and sexual diversity on campuses. It's not so much that the university itself suddenly feels more compelled to do it out of wanting their students to be more informed, as they're really trying to avoid the appearance of looking like they don't care.
Well, it certainly is interesting talking with Stephanie Keveney here from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. Now, your article, which is very well written, by the way, starts with an incident at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm not going to repeat the title of the campaign, but the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee told students that using the term political correctness is a microaggression. We talked about microaggressions a couple of weeks ago, particularly a blog post that a professor had posted at the University of North Carolina saying that it's inappropriate now to, for example, tell a female colleague that she has nice shoes because you're really telling her that she's worthless in terms of any academic value. The only thing that is of any worth is her shoes, which is utterly absurd. And yet the word microaggression is appearing more and more across stories like yours having to do with college campuses. Can you tell us a little bit more specifically what a microaggression is?
Sure. So when we technically think about discrimination, the first thing that pops into people's head are things like racial slurs or something that's very overt and noticeable as racist or sexist or homophobic. But we've now started hearing the term microaggression to describe anything that an individual might feel is less overt or might just hurt their feelings or make them feel traumatized in some way. So it can be something like asking someone where they're from because you're implying that they're not American, or anything like that, referring to someone who has a boyfriend or a girlfriend because you don't know their sexual orientation. We call these things microaggressions because it might just hurt a student's feelings.
Well, Stephanie, would you agree with me that this is absurd and ridiculous? I mean, to me, it just sounds like utter nonsense.
It absolutely is, and it's gone way too far. The academic who actually termed microaggressions in a piece of academic work to describe this kind of phenomenon has come out publicly and said that administrators and students have taken the idea of microaggressions too far, and they've tried to use it to operationalize campus policies that really dampen academic freedom and free speech on campus.
Well, it certainly, you know, it doesn't seem to be surprising that every couple of years a new, I don't know, strain of weirdness or absurdity comes from the left. Now, looking more at your article, specifically here in North Carolina, you mentioned that Appalachian State University prominently placed a bulletin board on campus denouncing white, male, able-bodied privilege in its student body. Who was behind that? How did it go? Is it still there? What do you know about that?
I don't specifically know who's behind it. It mirrors something that was displayed in the student residence halls last year, but it's now moved to the student union, which is kind of the hub of campus. And it has pictures of, like, popular internet memes, and it's making fun of straight white males for having these so-called privileges and kind of just really shaming them for attributes in their character that they have no control over. And it's telling them to check their privilege.
So this seems to be contradictory, Stephanie. On the one hand, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings by complimenting them on their shoes or asking them if they have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And yet, on the other hand, we can just smack white males blatantly and overtly. So how do they justify this somewhat hypocritical position?
It really comes back down to their definition of the word privilege and this idea that any individual who has any sort of privilege can be shamed in this way. But if we turn around and shame someone who is coming from a place of disadvantage, then it's discrimination, then it's a microaggression, and it's problematic.
Well, I can't keep up. I don't know if you can or not, but maybe we ought to just not talk. I think that's probably the goal at some point, that we all just walk around with, you know, duct tape over our mouths. In terms of other North Carolina-specific examples, you write that at UNC Asheville, students are required to attend a session which is called Multicultural Awareness with Multicultural Student Programs. They then take a 10-minute comfort break, presumably a necessity after the mental anguish incurred in the session. So when I was in college, of course, that was a long time ago, we never had comfort breaks. Is this a new phenomenon? And what do you make of this program at UNC Asheville?
Well, the comfort break piece, it probably is just a break in between sessions, but the need to deem it as something like a comfort break, it ties back into this general trend that we're seeing of being very careful and handling students very cautiously. And I think that just the term comfort break is indicative of the general atmosphere on campuses of treating children or students like children. The multicultural awareness piece itself is pointing to the fact that these students are being kind of inculcated with this social justice diversity awareness before they ever step foot into a classroom on college campuses, which I think is something that a lot of people aren't aware of, that they're being inundated with all of this during the summer before their freshman year.
Do you have any, and you may not, so forgive me if I'm catching you off guard, but do you have any feedback or data from this program at Asheville or from the thing at Appalachian with the white privilege? Are students taking this in stride? Are they finding it helpful? Are they laughing at it, finding it silly like I do? Or what is, have you been able to get any kind of barometer on how students are taking this sort of thing?
I know that from an article on the Privilege Board at Appalachian, it was mocked by students online. I think at all of the universities you have a very varied response, but it's definitely, if you accept it and you parrot the same kind of terminology that you're using, then you're going to fit in on campus. If you mock it or you disagree or you try to even question the logic of these kind of programs, then you're labeled as privileged and you're a microaggressor and you're violating the campus safety. And so it's a lot easier for students to either ignore it or go along with it. It can become much more difficult if they want to question the wisdom of these kind of programs.
Our guest is Stephanie Kevin, who's written an excellent piece called The Freshman Experience, Social Justice Indoctrination and Academic Handholding. Stephanie with the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, always a fantastic guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. There are other incidents in your article that you cite here specifically in North Carolina. And at UNC Chapel Hill, you write that students are participating in a session called Exploring Our Stories. The session description explains that, and I'll just quote you here, Interactive Theater Carolina will lead a workshop that will invoke thought and conversation about our personal identities and how they intersect. You will be participating and sharing in reflective conversation regarding the diversity of experiences and perspectives. Huh? What is that about?
Well, if you've ever wondered when exactly the students learned the terms intersectionality and microaggression and all of this new lingo, it's at sessions like this where they're forced into these situations where they listen to presentations about the very subtle discrimination on campus and how we have to respect everybody's own intersecting identities. And so these kind of workshops, they can be problematic. And when it comes to things like reflective conversation, it's not the kind of conversation where you would be encouraged to not agree with whatever you've just been told by the session leaders. It's something where you're supposed to be very cautious, and you're probably warned not to say anything too hurtful about anybody's other identity, and you might invalidate them.
I was just wondering, and maybe I'm off track here, but as I read the description about reflective conversation regarding the diversity of experiences and perspectives, I wonder how kids, I mean, we're talking freshmen, so typically maybe anywhere from 18 to 19 years old, they may have come up in life in a very difficult home environment or situation that they don't want to talk about, and they may leave that workshop feeling even more introverted, more ashamed, more unable to relate their own life experiences with others who might actually care about them. And I'm wondering if there's been any thought given to the negative implications of forcing freshmen to sit through this kind of thing, those who have things that they might consider embarrassing to share, and how they would walk away from that feeling bad about themselves.
I haven't seen any particular discussion on that issue. I think probably what happens is there's kind of a forewarning that you won't be forced to share anything that you don't want to. But I think you definitely raise a good point that it might not be a comfortable situation for everybody. The problem with these kind of sessions is that they're not very transparent, and so it's very hard for an outsider to know exactly what happens. So I can't speak specifically to what happens at Chapel Hill.
Right. At UNC Wilmington, you talk about students being required to attend sex-segregated campus safety sessions. Women are given tips on how to deal with unwanted attention and information on women-only rape aggression defense courses. Men told how much of a man you are should not be measured by how much you can drink. Both are given the definition of stalking, but only women are given information on how to deal with personal stalkers. I guess that's probably a safety thing. Maybe that's not that bad, or what do you think?
It's not that bad, but I think that it points to hypocrisy on the part of these campus groups that are talking about safety, because they've gone a long way to talk about how, one, there is no gender binary anymore, right? Like, we are not supposed to classify male or female. And so we can't do that at any time when we think it's appropriate, but apparently when they think it's appropriate, it's okay to start segregating by sex again. And they go very far to talk about how men are sexually assaulted too, and we should open up that conversation. But then when you actually look at the different scripts that are being given to men and women, it's made very clear that they're not actually talking about male sexual assault. They're just talking about men as aggressors, women as the victim.
Now, our guest, Stephanie Keveney from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, talking about an excellent article that she has. You can find it at popecenter.org, The Freshman Experience, Social Justice, Indoctrination, and Academic Handholding. Jumping down a little bit, there's obviously at Chapel Hill, first-year students encouraged to seek self-segregated living arrangements on campus. Living, learning residence halls are designated for students who want to be surrounded by like-minded individuals, including Pride Place, which is restricted to LGBTQ students and their allies, and Unitas, a house that actively works to challenge stereotypes and prejudice based on identities such as gender, race, nationality, religion, and sexual orientation. Stephanie, I'm getting the impression that college is not fun anymore. These kids are being put in situations where they have to think way too much about what they say and whose feelings they might hurt. I mean, Sounds like kind of a bummer to me.
It does to me, too. And I think the problem with segregated living arrangements, especially, is that you can choose not to be exposed to anyone with opinions that you don't want to be exposed to. It happens in the classroom, and now it happens in the living arrangements on campus. And so you realistically have students who can go their entire 4 years on campus never having to be exposed to contrary points of view, and I think that's really counter to what we imagine a university education would be like.
Stephanie, going on to, of course, North Carolina State, not to be outdone, they're included in your article, and Welcome Week, Wolfpack Welcome Week, featuring signature events such as Respect the Pack. You write, at this event, students make a vow to dedicate themselves to increasing diversity and inclusion on campus. In a video from the event, students explain that they respect the pack by correcting microaggressions, promoting cultural competency, respecting others' gender identity, and not appropriating others' cultures. Again, this just sounds too whacked to me. I mean, kids used to show up. They'd go to school. They'd go to class. They'd root for the football and basketball teams. And suddenly it seems as if the university experience has been just drowned in a sea of political correctness, and which I guess the word political correct, according to Wisconsin, you're not supposed to say that anymore. So, you know, you've got kids learning to adjust possibly from being away from home, and now they don't know what to say or who to say it to or how to think it, and it just seems like a real negative thing that's happening here at NC State and other colleges in North Carolina, as you have written.
Absolutely, and I think you see the effects in students just not wanting to be out there anymore in terms of their own personal viewpoints. It's a lot easier to just sit down and shut up and go along with whatever the most popular narrative is. And if the most popular narrative is that we have to be outright supporting diversity and inclusion and fighting microaggressions and cultural competency and all of this, then that's what students are just passively going along with, because they're not encouraged to speak their own mind or have their own opinions or act counter to this really, really oppressive atmosphere on campus.
Now, you make a good point here. You include Elizabeth City State University, East Carolina, and others, where students are required to take courses called freshman seminar, teaching time management skills, test-taking strategies, in some cases, learning to navigate the university. Reminds me, when I was in college, that University of South Carolina, we were told that athletes could take University 101, which was actually showing them where all the buildings were, and it was kind of a joke that it was, you know, something for the jocks. But this now has become a reality here in North Carolina, including UNC Asheville, Pembroke, Wilmington, Western Carolina. And you make a great point that students are being required to take these classes and forcing students to pay for classes that they may not need, and frustrating those who would otherwise excel in a more demanding academic environment. I know as a parent, you know, if I'm looking at my kids, you know, class list, and I'm having to pay, you know, for them to learn where the dining hall is, I think that's kind of something that I would not be real happy with.
I agree, and I think students feel the same kind of frustration when growing up and going through high school, you're told, you know, once you get to college, you're going to have so much more freedom to choose your own curriculum, and you're only going to be taking challenging classes, and it's going to be so hard. And then you get to college, and you're forced to enroll in classes that are teaching you how to manage your time and, you know, how to take a test and not get too stressed out and that kind of stuff. It's really counter to what I think a lot of students prepare for in college. But it's also indicative of this idea that colleges are admitting students who graduated from high school not ready for academic rigor. And so that's part of the problem that we're seeing here with all of these required courses, is In fact, a lot of students do need to learn these skills because they were never taught them.
Well, that's an excellent point. And as we come to the close of our segment here, I do like that you wrote that the University of Chicago has sent a letter reaffirming its support for a free and open marketplace of ideas, quoting, "Our commitment to academic freedom means that we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial, and we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own." Now, that's, I think, more like it, that the University of Chicago is saying, look, this other stuff is nonsense, and you're not going to find it here.
Yeah, we would love to see more universities, especially in North Carolina, take a real hard stance that the lessons freshmen especially need to learn is that we respect free speech and intellectual diversity and academic rigor, and we are not going to dampen other people's points of view, and we're not going to hold your hand through the entire process of transitioning into college, but we will make it an environment where you're free to kind of explore your own opinions, and you're going to have to hear some points of view that you may not like, but we'll give you the skills to counter those with your own opinions.
Well, Stephanie, you've written an excellent article, and you're always an excellent guest. We appreciate you coming on here. One last question. From where you sit, the research that you've done, is this going to gain traction and become a part of the university experience for, as far as we can tell, in the near term? Or do you think there's going to be some pushback as the, you know, the substance of these things finds its way to parents and others who might find this to be, you know, ridiculous and unnecessary? Do you think it's here for the long haul, or do you think that there is going to be some pushback?
I think it's very difficult to tell. As long as parents and students remain really apathetic and just accept that this is the new college experience, it's going to continue to grow in popularity. But if you see students and parents and decision makers stand up and demand that we restore academic rigor and freedom of thought on college campuses, I think that we could see the tides turn pretty quickly.
Well, we can hope for that. Stephanie Keveney of the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. You can find her work at popecenter.org. Thank you very much once again for being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks, Mark.
Always a pleasure to have Stephanie Keveney on the program. Good stuff at popecenter.org, and always good stuff here on What Matters in North Carolina. We're going to take a quick timeout, and on the other side, we'll be joined by Joe Bastardi, one of the best weather forecasters in the country. Find out what's going on in the Gulf and in the Atlantic and how it will affect our Labor Day weekend.
What time is it? Well, it's either time for a beer or time to turn on the Free to Brew podcast. Just like your color TV and the internet, craft beer is not going away anytime soon. Tune in to the show for a free market perspective on the latest in beer news, regulations, and why the brewing industry has more to do with North Carolina politics than you realize. We tackle the distribution cap, taxes, food trucks, labeling, packaging, and anything I can possibly get away with. Try out the latest podcast on your drive home today. That's the Free to Brew Show with me, your host, Greg Polsher. At the end of the day, you can't have beer without liberty, and you can't have liberty without beer.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver, and we've had some weather going on in the Atlantic, and also a little bit more concerning in the Gulf. And if it has anything to do with weather, obviously the voice to turn to is that of Joe Bastardi of WeatherBell.com. Joe, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, this definitely matters for North Carolina, so I'm glad to be back.
Well, we sure appreciate you taking time. So, first of all, there was a little dust-up, it looked like, out in the Atlantic. The latest that we've seen is that perhaps the Outer Banks have dodged anything serious. Is that what it looks like to you?
which one are we talking about now? The tropical depression that was in the Atlantic? Is that what you're thinking about? Or that's going out. But our mine is a very serious situation for North Carolina, especially the coastal communities and the sand hills. This is the center of the hurricane, which will make landfall tonight just east of Apalachicola. It looks to me by noon tomorrow it'll be located just to the west of Savannah, and then probably by Saturday near Cape Hatteras. So the entire, 6 to 10 inches of rain for our state, probably east and south of I-95, and wind gusts of 60 miles an hour along the beaches, what we're looking at tomorrow night and early Saturday.
Well, that sounds...
It's going to continue a little bit northeastward and stop likely dead in its tracks off the mid-Atlantic coast, and just really beach-bashing waves and all sorts of problems for the mid-Atlantic and northeast beaches. But it's coming through like a truck at eastern North Carolina. It's fortunately for us, it'll have a trajectory over land. That will knock the intensity down, but it'll still be a rude reminder of what this time of the year can produce from the tropics. And certainly, we were talking before season about how this summer would be hot in the mid and late summer and into fall, endless summer, and that hurricanes would have impact this year on the U.S. coast. Indeed, this is a prime example of the weather doing what we thought it was going to do.
Well, talking with Joe Bastardi here of WeatherBell.com. Now, as we started out, the tropical depression in the Atlantic, as you said, has moved on out. But Hermine, now, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I always thought that once they, hit land, they sort of weakened. But you're saying this one is just going to keep barreling on down.
Yeah, well, the reason most of them weaken, if they're very, very powerful, then anything that disrupts them from being so powerful does that. So it's like, okay, let's say you have a guy that bench presses 400 pounds. He lifts weights every day, and he tweaks his shoulder. Well, he can't bench press 400 pounds anymore, right? Just a little tweak. Let's say he only bench 150 pounds. Tweak his shoulder may not be that big a deal. Well, this is only a 150-pound bench press storm. It's not that powerful. So what happens is this. Even though it's just inland, it's still has the upper air support, and it has all sorts of moist air coming into it, warm tropical air coming into it, so that it has will maintain a relative status quo over land, and then as soon as it gets back out over the water again, it's going to wind right back up. It wouldn't surprise me a bit if it's stronger east of the Delaware coast than it was when it hit Florida. And so we're sort of fortunate in it's not coming from the Bahamas straight up over water where it gets to intensify. But it's still going to rack a lot of places. There's going to be trees coming down in the coastal areas. And, a 6 to 10 hour period where people are going to say, wait a minute, why is this thing over land and still being this strong? So that's what we think is going to happen. We have it as a 55 knot storm moving through North Carolina. And I really believe that that's going to be a real good forecast.
Well, Joe, let me ask you this. It seemed like, it was just there and nobody was really... Well, maybe you guys were, but I mean, the general public really didn't know about this thing. And all of a sudden, last 36 hours, it's...
Mark?
Yeah.
I have been following this thing for 15 days.
Really?
15 days. And I was surprised that it didn't start intensifying quicker. I'll tell you how concerned about this thing I was. I was out on the golf course. I took 9 hours off from my job to golf in a charity tournament, okay? Which, by the way, my team played second in.
There you go.
I was very happy about. But in any case, that's because of the other guys were better than me. I came off the 17th hole. I was watching, so I'm golfing, and I had said, guys, I got to leave. I have to update clients because finally I saw the evidence that was going to start cranking up. This was on Saturday afternoon. So what happens is you watch these things. But let me remind you something. Camille is one of the greatest storms ever to hit the United States back in 1969. 12 days it moved across the Atlantic and Caribbean, got to the western tip of Cuba, and within 36 hours became a Cat 3 hurricane, another 24 hours, Cat 5. You take Carol, 1954. Yesterday was the anniversary of Carol in New England, and, of course, it's sideswiped Hatteras, August 30, 31, 1954. And Carol came all the way across, didn't do anything, got to the north of the Bahamas, became a Category 3 hurricane. So you see this quite often. The thing that guys like me have to combat out there and everything else is that because people aren't looking, they go, oh, my gosh, look at how fast this blew up. but what about the 15 days where it didn't blow up, right? Or you take a look at, well, take a look at what just happened in Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
I started seeing this stuff 2 months before Hawaii, right? What happened? Madeline fell apart. Lester's going to the north. So when you use the weather in its totality, you realize not only are these storms not surprising because of what happened before, but you wonder why they haven't been worse. Because when you take something to a certain extreme, then it means that there's always a capability of it going a little bit further. And if we've seen previous examples to that, then we naturally look for those kind of things.
Well, our guest is Joe Bastardi with WeatherBell.com. So, yeah, you're right. You do this for a living, and folks like me just see the instant results when they suddenly get on the news and start turning heads. So her mind is going to be hitting, as you said, around Apalachicola and come across Florida. And so we can expect this to sort of ruin some beach plans in North Carolina.
Yeah, exactly right. It's going to ruin. And when it goes away, north of Hatteras, it's not like it's going to go away. I mean, I think the weather improves north of Hatteras, Corolla Lightning and places like those up the coast in there. But and it won't be as bad south of Hatteras down the coast. It's a matter of cleaning up whatever it does. But this certainly, for the mid and north Atlantic states, this is just going to ruin their weekend, a Labor Day weekend. And I saw a situation like this back in 2006 with Ernesto. When Ernesto came into the South Carolina, North Carolina border, and the Hurricane Center, it was inland for 12 to 24 hours, taking everything down. It got overchecked. It was in wind gusts 100 miles an hour. At Norfolk, Virginia, wind gusts of 75 miles an hour, Ocean City, New Jersey, 80 miles an hour, Ocean City, Maryland, totally destroyed the Labor Day weekend in those areas. But Labor Day weekend is like snowing, all right? If you're going to run holiday, Labor Day is like New Year's, that part of the week.
Well,
and that's part of the. If you've got any hurricanes around Labor Day, move Labor Day to December, and then you won't have to worry about Labor Day hurricane. How's that?
Well, we certainly have been blessed here in North Carolina with not having had significant storms in the last several years.
Since 2003 with Isabel came.
Yeah, exactly. So is there anything else that's out there, Joe, that guys like me have not been watching, but that guys like you have, that we might need to be concerned about in the next week or so?
There's liable to be something else getting ready to develop. But, hey, look, we said back at the beginning of the season, we expected, as you got into September and October, that I'm one of them now, it's called the Newfoundland Wheel, the tendency for high pressure to be over the Northwest Atlantic. And underneath that, you always look for trouble. In fact, you get situations like this. Even if Ermine wasn't there, looking at the weather map, I think something would try to develop in the Northwest Atlantic at this time of the year, and they don't move, there's usually trouble underneath. So we've got to understand that given this particular year, these storms that everybody loves to look at out in the middle of nowhere, whoa, look at that, it's got an eye or whatever, it's out in the middle of nowhere. They don't count. There's not going to be that of them. What we have to worry about is what seems to be innocuous waves that travel for 10 days across, and then when they get close to the United States, they start developing. And there's a reason for that. The water is very, very warm in the Western Atlantic. You got to remember something, Mark. In 1954-55, we only had 10 or 11 named storms, but we had 5 major hurricanes hit the eastern seaboard in a period of 2 years. Connie and Diane in North Carolina. We had Ione in North Carolina. We had Hale, North Carolina, South Carolina. Edna and Carol missed just to the east, but struck New England. That's the most remarkable. One of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in hurricane lore is 2 major hurricanes hitting in New England within 11 days of each other.
Yeah.
You realize if that happened now, people would be going to think of the rapture's coming because they don't have any knowledge of what happened before. So when you get a guy like me, it's funny today, you seem to get penalized for what you know, not what you don't know. It's almost as if they try to shut down things and they don't want people conscious of the facts. Well, I realized when I first got into meteorology, there were a lot of guys that were more intuitive than me. So I said, well, what's the best way I can well, the best way to compete with them is, do you know everything that happened yesterday? You have an advantage on someone because you need yesterday to figure out tomorrow. So, anyway, that's what we're looking at. So this is going to be a significant storm. It's not going to be the worst storm North Carolina's ever seen or anything like that. But it is going to be, folks, you're going to get under a 6 to 12-hour period where this thing is going to be rocking and rolling in the coastal areas, going up a lot. But then Florida and then the Mid-Atlantic beaches are probably going to get it worse than what North Carolina gets.
Okay. Well, Joe, as always, we appreciate your knowledge and your candor and your willingness to come on What Matters in North Carolina and keep us up to date on these weather conditions. Thank you very much,
well,
sir.
It's always my pleasure to do that, and I consider it a privilege and an honor you guys let me on, you know, especially with just as long as we don't have people that want to prosecute me for my views. Just doing the best I can, right?
I hear you. Well, thank you, and hope that you have a good Labor Day weekend. Thank you.
Well, you have a good Labor Day weekend, and you enjoy the weather because it's the only weather you got.
All right. Joe Bastardi from WeatherBelt with us here on What Matters in North Carolina. Well, we appreciate Joe Bastardi coming on What Matters in North Carolina. It sounds like we're going to get some pretty significant rain, particularly in the eastern part of the state, as he indicated. And looking at some of the other weather forecasts, they tend to concur along the eastern part of the state, on the eastern part of eastern side of I-95. Some pretty significant rainfall totals are being forecast. But this is an amazing storm, Hermine, coming from the Gulf. And by Sunday, outside of Maryland, I mean, this thing is moving. Joe said it's trucking right along, and he's right. And so this is that time of year, and What Matters in North Carolina, as you know, not always just politics and policy, but we will keep you up to date on all things that matter. And in this particular instance, severe weather. And as Joe said, not a big hurricane, but certainly a tropical storm that has a potential to do some damage and possibly flooding. And as he said, maybe taking out some trees because of the heavy rainfall. So stay tuned to your weather source that you like to get your weather from throughout the weekend, and certainly stay safe. Well, as we talked about earlier, the Supreme Court did not grant a stay in the voter ID case. Governor McCrory and the leaders of the General Assembly indicating that there are 30 other states that have common sense voter ID legislation. For some reason, the courts don't want that to be taking place here in North Carolina. And really what the interesting question is going forward is, what is the state to do? Are we just done with election reform legislation? Will they tee it up again in January when they convene for the long session and try again with new legislation that they hope would pass muster? Depending on how the presidential election goes, you know, this 4-4 divided court, if it goes left, there's no telling if any voting reform, election reform, will ever be approved as long as the left had a majority, if that turns out to be the case. So those that are going to be serving in the North Carolina General Assembly, they have a lot on their plate. When they come to town in January, they'll be looking at what to do with election reform. They'll also be looking at what to do with maps. They've got the Wake County School Board and commissioners. Will that need to be addressed, or is that an issue that will have been put to bed? Lots of things that they have done that have been undone by the judicial system. And so we've had several of the members of the General Assembly on the show, as you know, and there's a bit of frustration because they don't just come to town, folks, and toss this stuff in a hopper and suddenly you have law. They work on this stuff. They work on it very hard. They try to do what's right, and to have judicial activism, activist judges, judicial overreach, just shredding everything you try to do, it's very frustrating for the legislative branch. And that's why the Founding Fathers had the separation of powers, but certainly doesn't seem to be any separation nowadays. The Fourth Circuit and these panels and these federal judges who are intent on pushing forward their agenda. I mean, that's the only way you can look at it. They are basically exerting a lot more power than the executive or the legislative branch here in North Carolina. So getting back to some of the other things that have been talked about in recent days, you know, there was a big, big to-do about House Bill 2 and how every business and every convention and every tourist on the planet were just going to stop coming to North Carolina. And you remember that there was a death knell sounded by those on the radical left who just were completely infuriated about House Bill 2 and trying to protect women and girls. Well, it was announced recently today in the Business Journal, Triangle Business Journal, that tourism at some of North Carolina's major beach destinations, business has been steady and even up as the beach season looks to close here with the Labor Day weekend. And so folks are still coming to North Carolina. They are still enjoying the beaches in North Carolina, which are some of the best in the country. And this report says the numbers have been strong in Carteret County and Wilmington, a little flat in the Outer Banks. But revenue from the occupancy tax is up 6% for the Crystal Coast over the same time last year. And so Kim Huffman, it's reported here by the Business Journal, is the president of the Wilmington and Beaches Convention and Visitors Bureau, said that they've had a summer vacation run that exceeded last year's. Occupancy tax revenues through June 30th were up 6.87% compared to a year ago, and strong numbers expected for July. So, you know, folks, these people want to, you know, forecast doom and gloom over the state. It's the same thing they do with education. The media tries to exacerbate everything into its worst possible scenario. If you were to just go by the headlines of the News and Observer, or the Charlotte Observer, or the Greensboro News and Record, you would think that there's never been a business built in North Carolina, or the ones that have been built have all left, that there will never be another convention held in North Carolina, that there will never be another tourist in North Carolina. And, you know, along the same lines, every teacher in the state has gone to Houston to teach. There are no more schools open in the state. We have the worst education system, not only in the United States, but compared to third world countries. I mean, these headlines that you find in the News and Observer and the television stations and the Charlotte Observer, Greensboro News and Record, they're just so biased and so inflammatory and most of the time untrue. Because as you know, the state is doing very, very well. Huge surplus, not only from revenue, but from saving money. We have a General Assembly that is doing a very, very good job in saving money, in controlling spending, and yet increasing revenue by lowering taxes. How is that even possible? So, folks, don't listen to or believe the message that these inflammatory, emotionally based headlines will say to you, because they're wrong. They're just absolutely wrong. And I guarantee you, if the playing field were level, if the media, the mainstream media, were, I won't even say if they were biased to the right, if they were just honest, if they were just honest and reported things as they actually are, it would be very, very hard for any liberal to get elected, because the state is doing better than it has done in a long, long time. Balanced budget, revenue surpluses, teacher pay raises. In fact, WREL did a fact check, and lo and behold, who can believe this, but they actually admitted that the teacher pay in North Carolina is going to average $50,000 a year. That's not including, of course, their benefits and retirement and that sort of thing. But you would have thought that, you know, they would have never admitted that. And so while, to their credit, they told the truth. So while you have all these headlines, these doom and gloom and negative, hateful headlines coming from the left, that everything is going wrong, that everything is going south, that everything is horrible in our state, it's not. And if the media were responsible in to any degree, if they were responsible in North Carolina to any degree where they said that this is the average teacher pay, for example, and teachers are not leaving the state. You know, they tried to run this 2 years ago, and working in the General Assembly, I went to the Department of Public Instruction website, and lo and behold, the things that were being said in social media about teachers leaving and organizations like Policy Watch and all of that, they were just not telling the truth. For example, if you have a 13% teacher turnover rate, well, they want to tell you that, you know, first they'll say something like 30% of North Carolina teachers are leaving. But then when you dig down and see that it's only really actually about 13%, oh, by the way, many of those have retired. Many of those have moved from one school district to another. Many of those have changed careers. You find out that the actual number of teachers leaving the state to go teach in another state is less than 2%. But they won't tell you the truth. See, folks, if the media were just honest, it would be very hard for any liberals to be elected. Why? Because the truth is very powerful. The problem is, those that are supposedly committed to journalistic integrity don't have the spine or the backbone to tell the truth, but instead they are committed to an agenda. And I'm not sure what that agenda is, unless it's sexual promiscuity and no religion. But the fact of the matter is, what's so wrong with the state that the left feels just so inclined to have to try to want to change things? If you roll the tape back 6 years, the state had a horrendous, nearly $3 billion budget deficit. Is that what people that write headlines for the News and Observer and Charlotte Observer want? Teacher pay was frozen. Is that what they want? Do the people at the Greensboro News and Record want a state health plan that is in disarray? I don't know. I don't know what the motivation is for those in, quote, journalism to do the things that they do, to blaze these doom and gloom headlines, these hateful headlines that try to undermine everything good that's going on in our state. I'm really not sure what their motivation is, unless they just want the ultimate society where there's no rules, no morals, no morality, no restraint on sexual behavior, and no allowance at all for religious freedom and for people of faith to have any voice. Perhaps that's the ultimate objective. But if you're committed at all, then to integrity, to telling the truth, then you should tell the truth. Instead of these headlines, these stories, these opinions, editorials that are just so terrible. Tourism is not only robust in North Carolina, occupancy taxes on the coast are up. That is the truth. That means that House Bill 2 is not destroying the tourism industry in our state. And so you need to stay closely tuned to programs like What Matters in North Carolina, and encourage your friends, your family, to download the podcast. Look for us in the iTunes and Google Play Store. You can subscribe and listen every day and hear the truth. Things are going very, very well in North Carolina. Very well. And we have the sensible, prudent leadership of the Republican majority in the General Assembly to thank for that. I mean, think about it. Lowering taxes and state revenues increase. I don't know. Don't make any sense to me either. But it's happening. Why? Because lower taxes creates the opportunities for businesses to hire more people, less business regulation. Lower taxes means people have more money in their pocket. They can go buy more stuff, and that means that there's a demand for stuff, which means more stuff has to be made and sold, which means businesses hire more people, and the wheel goes round and round. We've seen great unemployment numbers in North Carolina. All of these things should be heralded across the headlines of the Greensboro News and Record and the Raleigh News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer. But instead, you would think we are living in squalor in this state. They don't want, for example, Pat McCrory to win re-election. So, in fact, you know, 4 years ago, it was discovered through emails that were uncovered that they want to eviscerate him. And they're doing their best, regardless of how well he has done as governor, regardless of how well the General Assembly has been managed and prudently been guided through coming out of a recession, the left doesn't care. They just don't care. And yet, again, I don't understand their motivation. I'm not sure what it is they want. What do they think life would be like if there were only, if the liberals were once again in control of the governor's mansion and the General Assembly? Again, you know, financially, things are going well in our state. So perhaps it has to do with morality and faith and just furtherance of things that are, you know, have to do with sexual behavior. I don't know. I don't know what they're trying to get as their ultimate end. But I do know that it is a real shame. And I don't know how these people live with themselves. They go to journalism school, you know, and they get a job, you know, they come on WRAL, WTVD, some of these other television stations, and there's no integrity. There's just no journalistic rigor. There's no sense of truth. We have an agenda. The agenda is all-encompassing, and it is all-important, and it's really a shame because it shouldn't be that way. There was a time in this country where, you know, journalistic integrity was important, but it doesn't appear to be the case anymore. So anyway, we've had a great show today. We talked with Stephanie Keveney, and she's at the Pope Center for Higher Education, talking about some of the silly things that, well, ridiculous things that colleges are doing now to indoctrinate freshmen. And I determined that the only thing that incoming freshmen need to do is just don't talk ever again, at least while they're in school. And that way they'll, you know, stay out of trouble. They won't offend anybody. And probably that will offend somebody, though. So not talking would probably be deemed a microaggression. So maybe that's not a good idea either. We have seen through our conversation with Joe Bastardi that your Labor Day plans might be better toward the end of the weekend, as we see that her mind is going to come barreling across the Florida and then up Georgia and the North Carolina coast. And so you might want to be aware of that and make sure that everybody is safe and everything's battened down. Sounds like it's moving pretty fast, but going to dump a lot of water in a very short period of time. So things that matter in North Carolina, we have talked about the voter ID. And Francis DeLuca of the Civitas Institute saying he wasn't surprised once that Justice Roberts took it to the full court. And we're going to have a great show for you tomorrow, by the way. We're going to talk with Daryl Allison, who is very much involved with school choice. He is the president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. And we saw some news recently that more and more people in North Carolina are opting out of the traditional public school system. And so we're going to talk to Daryl about that. Very excited about that. And then the new House Majority Leader, Representative John Bell, will be our guest on What Matters in North Carolina on Friday. So look for that. And we will be back and hope to talk to you tomorrow.